For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We are off to an amazing place, an amazing island, about 7 miles off the coast of Ireland, if I understand correctly, the location of Skellig Michael, an island that in some respects is among the most famous islands in the world. It is not a small island, but very striking in appearance. And as a matter of fact, much of the world came to know Skellig Michael because it was utilized in the filming of the Star Wars film in 2014. And so a lot of eyes have seen Skellig Michael because of that. But we can get to know this remarkable and beautiful place courtesy of a book that is just being published in America called Returning Light, 30 Years on the Island of Skellig Michael. And my morning show guest is the author of the book, Robert L. Harris. And he simply answered an ad and took a job on Skellig Michael. And in some ways, much to his surprise, ended up returning to Skellig Michael year after year after year over the course of more than 3 decades. And the experience of living and working on this particular island, that is the story told in this lovely book published by Mariner, again titled Returning Light, 30 Years on the Island of Skellig Michael. And Robert L. Harris joins me now on the morning show, actually speaking from Skellig Michael through the wonders of modern technology. Robert L. Harris, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be able to speak with you. I'm standing in a little hut on the island, and it's blowing a gale outside. So if you hear the wind behind me, that's what you hear.
Absolutely. And we should say that you answered that ad in the Kerryman back in 1987. And in those early years when you worked on Skellig Michael, there was no such thing as there was no such thing as a cell phone for most people, but even if there were, there would have been no service available. And so the means by which you have communicated has changed over the years.
Yes, indeed. It's changed dramatically. And there is a bit of internet coverage now. There's cell phone coverage, and we have more of a connection with the outside world. It has changed. I certainly found it bracing and invigorating in the old days when we didn't have that communication. And I think in some ways it prepared me for living here in a certain way, because it made me depend on resources that I might not have otherwise acquired or knew that I had or knew that most people have, I suppose, and taught me to, I suppose, in a way, try to communicate or at least understand in a different way than the normal chains of connection.
Skellig Michael is sometimes called simply the Rock, and my understanding is that first part of its name, Skellig, means splinter of stone. What about the Michael part of the name?
Well, Michael is from the dedication to Saint Michael, and there was a very strong cult of Saint Michael in the medieval period here in Ireland. And to put it briefly, in Scripture, Michael is the leader of the angelic hosts. He's a warrior figure, and these monks that lived here long ago considered themselves to be spiritual warriors. Here at sort of the front line of things, out at the very edge of what would have been known as the edge of the earth back in the 6th century. And so they dedicated it to St. Michael as their protector.
Hmm. Before we talk about the island and your experience of living on it and working there over these many years, I think it would be interesting for our listeners to learn a bit about your own intriguing life, even ahead of the beginning of your experience on Skellig Michael. For instance, where you were born and where you spent a lot of your childhood and where you received your education. Give our listeners whatever background you think will be helpful for them.
Okay. Well, I have kind of a rambling history for the beginning of my life. I was actually born in South America. Both of my parents were from the United States. They were from the Southeast. And so I spent a little bit of time there when I was in grade school. And but then my parents moved, and we lived by the sea again in the Caribbean. And when I came to go to university, I spent some time over in Scotland, again by the sea, so I was used to being by the sea, and I met my wife there, who was from Ireland, and we moved over to the northwestern part of Ireland, and that's where I've been based for since 1980, since I moved to Ireland and made it my home, and I've been working here down in the southwestern part where my wife was originally from. Since 1986, since I answered that the advertisement to come out and work on Skellig Michael at that time.
Tell our listeners about that, what that ad was saying, and the position that was open on Skellig Michael.
Well, I had always been curious about these remote islands. Like I said, I grew up by the sea a fair bit, and the idea of monks long ago putting themselves out in remote places, in all traditions, and many other traditions besides the Christian one, seemed a very intriguing thing. So when the opportunity came, and also I had studied a bit of medieval history when I was in university, so when the opportunity presented itself, I was in my mother-in-law's house, and just by chance, I saw an old newspaper. It was already a couple of weeks old, with the ad sort of sticking out right there for me to look at it. And they were the Irish government was preparing to set up a guiding service and sort of a warden service on this island, because previous to that, since the 1820s, it had been manned by lighthouse keepers, but the lighthouses were being automated all around the coast of Ireland. And so a presence was required here, because at the top of this mountain where I live, when I'm here, there are invaluable ruins, not really ruins, in a way the little village is intact, of a place where a small community of Christian monks lived 1,200 years ago on a little terrace sticking out over the sea. So it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It's a place where many people come for all kinds of reasons. So obviously it needed protection. And as well as that, there are hundreds of thousands of seabirds who come here who are also protected. So a presence was required. And so I answered the ad, and really, literally, within about 2 weeks, I was here.
Hmm. Was this a decision that you arrived at easily? And I'm wondering also about this decision in regards to your wife. I mean, is this something yeah. in which she was going to be accompanying you to Skellig Michael?
Well, that's interesting. Everyone always wants to know how my wife felt about this. And, of course, there is that old adage of absence makes the heart grow stronger. And maybe our relationship has improved by periods of absence. She has been here plenty of times. Unfortunately, she couldn't come and live here with me. But particularly in the early years, when our children were very young, they came out often. And I think it's become... it was already a part of her life, really, to tell you the truth. We had come to the island for the first time 2 years before. In fact, that's one reason I answered the ad, because my wife and I had come here and just felt very attracted, strongly attracted to the place. And so she was all for me coming here and for having a connection with the place. And I hope, anyhow, at this late stage, 37 years later, that my family feels enriched for the connection that it has had with the island.
Hmm. At the time that you began working there, what kind of a staff are we talking about of which you were a part? And I think that has changed a little bit over these intervening decades.
Yes, there's much more of a presence here now. When I first came, there were two workmen who came out on a Monday morning and left on a Friday evening and helped to maintain some of the of the monument here. And then just myself and one other person, another guide, arrived out. We really had no idea what we were facing and arrived out to stay. So generally, particularly on weekends, or at least almost a third of the period, it was just myself and one other guide. And thankfully, both of the people who I worked with that year have turned out to be very amiable friends, and we have worked well together over the years.
Explain to our listeners kind of the season in which you find yourself on Skellig Michael. That is, it is not a place, I think, where you are the year round.
No, not at all. The Atlantic can come up in a very severe way in the wintertime, and there's only a small landing area here, and it is often beset by storms. In fact, today, no one can come out to the island. We have a southwesterly gale blowing out here, and the landing is unapproachable. And just to give you an example, at the end of the year last year, we were set to leave in early October, and it was a bit of a bad forecast in the offing, so we decided to bring that forward a couple of days, and it's just as well that we did, because after that, it was not possible to land on this island for a couple of months until around Christmas time. So it gives you some idea, hopefully, of just the nature of access here. It is often unpredictable. So we come out briefly in early May, hopefully around about that period, and stay until early October. And normally I stay here 2 or 3 weeks at a time and then go ashore for a week, and we kind of rotate that way.
Right. What you were just describing in terms of the day today reminds me of one of my favorite passages from your book, which is this: "If the sea is rough, and I know that no boats are going to land that day, that can be liberating, because then I know I've got time to myself." So in other words, for you, you, at least to some extent, or at least in some respects, welcome days like today when you know no tourists are coming ashore. I mean, at the risk of sounding maybe a little antisocial, I mean, there is something to be said. There is a silver lining to those days when the conditions do not allow for anyone to visit.
That's right. That is absolutely true. I enjoy meeting the visitors. You meet people here from all over the world, and the place, it's such a tiny little rock, but it strikes people in many unusual ways, and it's interesting the things you learn about people out here. But it is also interesting to spend time on my own here, and it's a wonderful place for. Well, I wouldn't want to describe it as it's not a holiday island, but it's a place where you come to understand your place in the world and in the cosmos in a way that perhaps a lot of people don't have the opportunity to. At least I have found that, and so I find it valid to spend time here in that way.
We're speaking with Robert L. Harris, the author of a book called Returning Light, 30 Years on the Island of Skellig Michael. And, of course, it's been more than 30 years by now that you have spent long portions of the year working on Skellig Michael. Is your official title steward?
I am the supervisor guide here. That is my position. And basically what that means is I monitor the access, because people come and go down to the pier when the weather is fit and good. And it can be very fine at times. We've had a particularly good start to the summer. It's just that today is a very rough day. But then also I look after the access routes on the island. But mainly I'm responsible when visitors come for their safety, and I'm telling them a little bit about the place. And so it's kind of, the job has many different aspects, but on a day-to-day basis, when the visitors aren't here, it's basically looking after the place.
Describe to our listeners in a little more detail exactly how Skellig Michael is laid out and just how small an island it is. And also, if you would, describe the two peaks that that primarily comprise its landmass.
Yes, well, the island is 8 miles off the coast, the southwestern coast of Ireland, off County Kerry. And it's the only rock on the horizon line, except for its sister rock, called the Little Skelligs. So when you approach by sea, or when you're looking out from the mainland, you see these two dark pyramids off on the horizon. And they must have been interesting and appealing to people from prehistoric times, because they're very, very prominent on the horizon line. And so they obviously were interesting, because in early Irish lore, islands were places of spiritual importance. So these islands have drawn people for millennia, really, even long before the monks came. But when you arrive, there are two peaks, as you said. And on the near peak, near the top, that's the platform where the monks built their little community. And it's an incredible place, because literally they built up a dry stone wall into the air and terraced it and put their little dry stone beehives there, a little compact place where maybe a dozen monks lived. And you access it by walking up the road from the pier along a road that was built in the 1820s to access the lighthouse. And then about a third of the mile, about half a mile up the road, you turn and start going up ancient steps that the monks built. And you go up 600 steps, really a vertiginous route. You feel as if the land is falling away to the right and to the left of you as you go up. And you arrive at the little monastery on the easternmost peak. But then halfway up to that monastic platform, there's a little valley. And on to your left-hand side, on the western side, as you arrive there, there's a higher peak, a much more difficult peak of access, with no steps rising to the top. And it's much more pointed, much more angular. And they're just handholds and toe holes that pull you up there. And up near that peak, there are ruins of a little hermitage where we think maybe one man lived alone, or where solitary monks went up for individual prayer up to that peak. So it's quite a dramatic place. And at this time of year, it's filled with bird life. There are tens of thousands of seabirds that are flying around, these very colorful puffins and the huge gannets. So they make the rock seem very much a living place.
Hmm. you pulled away from calling them ruins. That is what remains of that monastery, and it sounds like, or I'm guessing that one reason why you hesitate to call them ruins is because they are not nearly as ruined as we might assume them to be. Tell us just how well preserved these remains are.
Yes, they're remarkably well preserved. I mean, the monks came out to this island because they were looking for a remote place. They harked back to the desert fathers who lived in desert places in Egypt. They wanted to go out to a wilderness. And so because of that, the place is preserved by its remoteness for us today. And the sea, in a way, has kept the place in a little time warp. As I mentioned, you walk along a pathway built by lighthouse keepers in the 1820s, but then you turn and start going up the mountain, and you might as well be going into the 7th century, because I'm sure it doesn't look all that different than it did when the monks climbed those steps. And when you get to the monastery itself, it's remarkable how well preserved it is. There have been collapses at different times over the centuries, and once you have an eye for it, you can see where dry stone walling has collapsed and been rebuilt. And the tops of the beehives in some places have fallen in and had to be rebuilt. But a fair portion of the masonry of these structures has to be original and monastic. So you get a very, very keen sense of entering a different time when you go there. So in that sense, you can stand inside those little dark cells and feel very much a presence of earlier people living there in a way that you don't in places that are reconstructed or places that are placed in sort of a different sort of surrounding that the modern world impinges upon.
Right. There's a lovely passage in the book when you talk about how you can stand in a particular place in that the remains of that monastery and think of someone being there, standing in that same spot more than 1,000 years earlier. And you say, he had a whole different worldview than I do, but I do share some things with him, because what I can see can't be all that different from what he saw. I mean, especially when it comes to things like the way the sunlight comes in through that window, and the way that room is illuminated, that in a sense, very little of anything would be different in this moment in 2023 versus what it was like, what it looked like more than 1,000 years ago. I mean, the thought of that is just breathtaking.
Yes, that is true. And it never really ceases to amaze me. And it's such an enriching experience for people. I mean, the way I think of it is I've been here a long time. I might possibly have been here longer than anyone has for a very, very long time. But on the other hand, my experiences also are shared by people who are just here and just walk into the place, because you stand and you just have the horizons of sea and sky around you. And you look over at the coastline, but most times you really can't make out houses or roads. So those headlands and those cliffs look more or less similar to what they would have looked like when people were here long ago. And so you definitely share so much, the basic things, with people who lived here, who made the big effort to come out here. And, of course, I don't see the world exactly the same way, but I have to share a lot of the things with those people, just in basic physical requirements and needs and wants and desires and wishes and hopes, those sort of things.
Absolutely. In the matter of light, and light is something you write about a great deal in your beautiful book, Returning Light. I mean, the book certainly lives up to its lovely title. You talk at one point about how the monks who constructed this monastery so long ago, is it the 7th or 8th century? I think we are actually a little uncertain on exactly when it was constructed, but that one imagines that they thought a great deal about light. And in a sense, I think at one point you talk about how these edifices were built to, in a sense, store the light or showcase the light in very special and beautiful ways. Can you describe what you're talking about there?
Yes. Well, I mean, I suppose I and thank you for reading the book in that way, because what you have described is, I think, very apt. Well, to give you a very clear example, there is a large cell when you first enter the monastery, and I was kind of fascinated by how the light was falling at different times of year in that cell. There are windows in this very large cell where the light is directed and where it falls on the floor or rising on the wall, depending on the time of day and the time of the season. And I was just fortunate enough to be thinking about that and thinking about light and other edifices that I have been to, like large cathedrals and other places where it's important how the light falls. And early on in my years here, I realized that this light in late September at the time of the equinox was rising up along near the doorway. If I can describe it accurately, falling through a window on the western side, a little window high up in the dome on the western side of the cell, and falling across the dark cell and striking the wall and moving slowly up along the wall and entering a little pocket between two lintels directly over the doorway. Just at the time, in late September, which coincides with the day and the night are equal. And that was fascinating to me because I know that many other sites in Ireland and in Britain, for that matter, have been constructed in such a way to showcase sort of astronomical events like that. And so for many years, I have looked at that situation and realized that this happens on a regular basis, that the sun rises right up along the wall and into that little pocket, we call it a light box in some cases, between two lintels at the top of the door, round about the last week in September every year. And so I started thinking a fair bit about how obviously these things weren't put there just haphazardly. There must have been a reason for the direction and the orientation of all the structures there. It's just impossible for us to know at this great length of time having passed. But the monastery itself is laid out on the east-western axis. And recently, at midsummer, I was up at the sunrise and realized that far off to the east, the sun was rising over the sister island, the Little Skelligs, and the light was coming right in from the opposite direction into the cells. And when you're there, that gives you a very enriched picture of the dynamics of the place, because you realize that these things must have meant a lot to people back then in a way that we're kind of, I suppose we don't really have that exposure so much just to the outer elements as early people did. And I mean, that's kind of a cliche. Lots of people say that sort of thing. But here you have kind of living proof of people long ago directing the light. What it meant is anyone's guess, but obviously it's something that they were concerned enough about to include it into how they built their structures, how they directed the light. So no more than medieval people building a Gothic cathedral and it being built in such a way to capture the light, to hold the light. I think in some ways these people did something similar.
Mm, I love that. And I love the way you write about light at one point, referring to the strange moving music of light. And one of my favorite passages in the book is actually when you are not talking about light, for instance, streaming through a window in this old monastery or in some other way, but the way in which light interplays with the water. You write at one point, a pool of water would glimmer, shimmering in silver. There was no other way to experience these things than to accept them as gifts, as the acquisitions of a spirit somehow emptied, at least temporarily, by its stay here. I'm wondering, before you ever came to Skellig Michael, is that the kind of thing that you would have been apt to observe and deeply appreciate? Or did you only come to a capacity to appreciate such a thing after living in a place like Skellig Michael for such a long time?
I don't know. Maybe a bit of both. I've always found it very enriching to be in situations by myself in exposed places. I've lived on islands before. I've lived on the coast of Ireland before I came here, and I share those interests with my wife and with other people that I know. And I suppose it's been a feature of my growing up. But on the other hand, I definitely feel that my being out here has given me a completely different perspective on that sort of thing and the importance it can have, how it can, an appreciation of or a perception of things like that can enter into yourself, and they can be very much a part of you, almost in a physical way. I think I wrote a bit in the book about how a map of the place, even though it's a small island, in a way it becomes possible to kind of map the island within myself. That's difficult to terminology maybe, but I tried to write about that in the book and to explain that in a way, and I suppose it's not just myself. I'm only hopefully illuminating something that happens maybe for everyone in their lives, depending on where they are and what sort of location they're in. But eventually where you live becomes a part of you and you carry it with you. And I think that's probably what I was trying to describe.
Hmm. We're speaking with Robert L. Harris, author of Returning Light, 30 Years on the Island of Skellig Michael. Skellig Michael, just off the coast of Ireland, an exceptionally beautiful, striking island, and a place that has been one of Robert L. Harris's homes for more than 30 years. One of the intriguing things about the book is that you help us appreciate the solitude that often is a part of being on Skellig Michael, particularly on a day like today, this day that we're recording this interview, in which it is not possible for anybody to visit the island. And those are days in which you enjoy a solitude that you otherwise might not. Let's just talk a moment about who visits Skellig Michael. My understanding is that there is a fairly steady progression of different boats that are, in a sense, authorized to come and bring what I guess would be tourists coming to Skellig Michael on a fairly regular basis. Tell us kind of the scope of that, and at least in general, how many visitors you and your colleagues are welcoming to Skellig Michael.
Yeah, well, as I said earlier, we're here generally from early May until early October, and over that period of time, on some days of the week, it is possible to land here. On average, I would say about 5 days out of seven, if you put all those 5 months together, boats are landing here on the island. And I go down in the early morning and have a look at the landing and at the sea conditions and see can we open the island later on in the morning. And then, if that's possible, we have 15 boats that the Irish government allows to travel to the island, and they can carry 12 each. So we could have 180 people here on a day from maybe about 9 in the morning to about 3 in the afternoon. all kinds of people come here. And yes, a lot of them are tourists. The place has become much more on the tourist route, the tourist map, than when I first came here. When I first came, it was a day's experience to come to the Skelligs. The trip was probably about twice as long by sea as it is now, because now we have much faster boats. The boats were much more exposed. It was much more like the old days, I suppose, coming out to the island. And when people came, they made it a big journey. Some people even came and stayed in the area for a couple of days to make sure they could get here. Now, unfortunately, people have to book a long ways ahead of time because it is such a popular place. It's not impossible to walk down to the pier on Port McGee, 8 miles away, and get a seat, but it's more likely that people would have booked. Anyway, a lot of people are coming here because they realize it's a very famous place, and they've read about it, and it's possibly on their so-called bucket list and that sort of thing. But you find other people too who come for all kinds of reasons, and it still has a spiritual attraction for many, many people. And some people come because, I suppose, like myself, they're attracted to these dark rocks off on the horizon, and they want to come out and just experience being here and looking out at the horizons of sea and sky the way people have from time immemorial. So there's quite a variety of people that come here, and it's really interesting sometimes to meet just the radical views that you come across when people see the place for the first time or touch foot on the rock. I think I said earlier, when you go up the steps, it is a very steep route, and you feel sometimes that the land is falling away to your right and to your left, and normal sort of perspectives change when you climb up such a steep route up to the monastery. So it's kind of a place where, what should I say, I think probably barriers are lifted. And people are apt to tell you anything about themselves here.
This is one of the things you write when, in terms of the people that you meet who visit Skellig Michael, and I just love this. You write, "Each person I meet coming up the road in the morning from the shore becomes every man, every woman. Each solitary creature encountered, however insignificant, becomes every other living thing." Earlier you say this was a place for a quiet and often unspoken exploration of or sharing of a common humanity, the open doorways of the cells beckoning from another time, offering a glimpse of another way of seeing. It's a lovely way to think of what it means to encounter people in a place like Skellig Michael versus what it would be like if you encountered them in a crowd in, I don't know, downtown Belfast or in Times Square in New York City. I mean, just the experience of encountering people is very different in this kind of setting.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. You're absolutely correct. And it's kind of refreshing, really. You know, I spend a lot of time ashore as well, of course, and I have my life there. And I don't know. I suppose it's not unusual to feel frustrated or despondent a bit about humanity and what we're doing with ourselves, and how we don't seem to be able to, first of all, just get on, I suppose, to put it simply and maybe naively. And yet, it's interesting that everyone I meet here just about seems to have an openness about them that I think has probably been made copper fastened, rather, by the boat journey, which can sometimes be arduous, or the climb, so that I suppose there's kind of a level playing field made by the physical surroundings that maybe makes people see each other in a slightly different way. Certainly, it's done so for me.
Right. And then on the other hand, you know, on days like this, when you are alone, there is this beauty of solitude that about which you also write in such striking fashion. This passage is among my favorites. Often no one else is there to stand beside me on the island, and the skies and surrounding rock are empty. The mind wanders. Links with the past are easily made. Ancient ways of viewing things come alive. The monks had stood there centuries before us, establishing their own lookout upon the beyond. And we are envious of anybody who gets to stand there and experience it. I do want to take a couple of minutes to talk about something that, in a sense, helped dramatically change the kind of sort of public profile of Skellig Michael. And that occurred in 2014 with the filming of scenes from Star Wars, The Force Awakens, scenes from that film that were filmed on Skellig Michael. What can you tell us about how such a thing ever came about?
Well, the simple answer is I don't know. I was on the island one day, and I believe it was the year that the filming went on, 2014, and up came some people from the film company who told me that this was afoot. So I don't really know what was the decision making process was. So I can't really answer, but if the films were partly filmed here, and for about 2 weeks on two consecutive years, there was a lot of activity here, setting up for the filming, and then the island was closed on 3 days each year for the actual filming those years back in 14 and 15. Yes.
And what did it feel like for you to have that kind of activity on Skellig Michael, so drastically different from anything you had experienced before? I mean, and did it feel like a kind of a jarring intrusion?
Well, I mean, just personally, yes, it did. It was pretty shocking to see sort of all the trappings of modern technology being set up on the island. Everyone was very respectful, I will say that. And, you know, it was something I had to get used to. And I was glad that I was here to help look out for different things here that most people might not have been aware of. For instance, bird nesting sites and things like that. But obviously, there were severe restrictions on with regard to any interference. And so all of that worked quite well. I wouldn't have been personally happy with the decision to bring any kind of commercial development out here. But on the other hand, the story of Star Wars, I grew up with myself, a human being like everyone else, and I enjoyed the movies when I was young. And, you know, I see the appeal of, and particularly in youngsters when they come up and they want to know about different aspects of where the film was made. And, you know, it's a long time ago now, actually. It's moving on 8 years ago, isn't it? And so I've it's sort of become a part of the place in its own way.
Right. And, of course, I think a lot of us hearing about this reference now want to go back and see that film again and watch for the scenes in which Skellig Michael is the striking backdrop. I realize we are just about done, but we have not really mentioned hardly at all the incredible wildlife that is on Skellig Michael. Although I think you have made brief reference to the enormous bird population there that is an unmistakable part of the island and its ecosystem. Briefly describe to our listeners just the wondrous array of creatures who make their home there and what it is like to, in a sense, live among them.
Yes, well, it is very much a part of living here. You know, in a way, the island extends out over the ocean and into the ocean with its wildlife. And when you're approaching in the summertime, there are thousands of large white North Atlantic gannets that are flying around the boats in great circles, and there are an equal number of puffins who are very colorful flying in the air about the island. And these little creatures, they go out to sea and they dive down 60 meters or so and come back up with beaks full of fish and bring them into little ones. And the island is just alive with activity now. But over time, you realize that it's not restricted just to that. In the wintertime, these birds, the puffins go out in the North Atlantic. The little storm petrels fly way off south of the equator and are flittering around down there off the coast of Brazil. And in the springtime, there was a little switch that's turned on in all of their heads, hundreds of thousands of these birds. And they all come right back into the same little burrow or the same little place between stones to the same a mate, if he or she is still alive. And they can live to be 30 or 40 years old. So I like to think that the skelligs in the wintertime is spread out all over the ocean, and in the summer only, it comes back to roost on this hard rock here. And it's magical because most people are not aware of that. They don't see a lot of these birds. Little storm petrels, people hardly ever see them. And yet they are an indicator of something very, very vibrant that is going on in the world around us that's very precious and that is totally dependent on this rock jutting out off the Irish coast.
Hmm. Do you foresee Skellig Michael being a part of your life for some time to come?
Well, it'll always be a part of my life. I don't know how much longer I can work here, but I hope to work as long as I can. And regardless, I don't know that I'm ever going to be able to escape it.
Mm-hmm. The book again is Returning Light, 30 Years on the Island of Skellig Michael. And the book, by the way, includes some wonderful photographs. It is published by Mariner, the author Robert L. Harris. Robert L. Harris, it was a pleasure to speak with you about your life and about the experiences you've had on Skellig Michael. Thank you so much, and very, very best wishes to you.
My pleasure. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Jonathan Scott, the author of an absolutely fascinating new book called Into the Groove. It is an exploration of one of the great miracles of man-made science that we so take for granted, the recording of sound. His book chronicles the development of that from before the time of Thomas Alva Edison, the inventor of the phonograph, all the way through to the development of the long playing record. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. On Thursday, Nan Calvert pays her monthly visit to the program. We're going to be learning about Glacier Land Resource Conservation and Development, a nonprofit organization based in Green Bay that promotes sustainable living on all kinds of different levels and in really every facet of our day-to-day lives. And We'll actually be talking with Kirsten Jersick, who is on their staff, and she is one of their grazing specialists. And we will find out about some of the good work that she and her colleagues do. Then on Friday, we're going to be previewing the Racine Theatre Guild's newest production, which is of John Larson's groundbreaking musical, Rent, which is a modern-day retelling of one of the most beloved of all operas, Puccini.